During my practice as a psychotherapist, I was once contacted by the parents of a 20-year-old woman under psychiatric care who, for several months, had been undergoing medication, hospitalization, and shock treatments. She had become mute 3 months before her parents contacted me. When they brought her to my office, she had to be assisted because, left to herself, she just sat and stared at the floor. In my office, she crouched in her chair, shaking, her eyes on the floor. I tried to connect empathically with what feelings and needs were being expressed through her nonverbal message. I said to her, "I'm sensing you're really scared. You have a need for safety, need to be sure that if you talk, you'll be safe. Is that accurate?" She didn't respond verbally. She just sat there. I said, "I'm guessing that it's scary even to talk. Is that so?" She continued sitting there. Then I expressed my own feelings, saying, "I'm very concerned about you, and I would like to contribute some way to helping you feel more safe. I'd like you to tell me if there's something I could say or do that would make you feel safe." Still no verbal response. For the next 40 minutes, I continued to either reflect the feelings and needs I sensed were being expressed through her silence, or at other times I expressed my feelings and needs. There was no verbal response. Finally, after about 40 minutes, I said, "Oh, I'm feeling really tired right now, need some rest. How about if we get together tomorrow? Would you be willing to do that?" I got no verbal response from her, and so I said, "Well, if I don't hear you say anything, I'll assume it's okay, and I'll ask your parents to bring you back tomorrow." The next day was like the first day. I continued to hear through her silence what I guessed she was feeling, needing. I told her at times my feelings and needs, but she still didn't respond verbally. Third day the same. Fourth day the same. This time, when she didn't respond, I reached over and held her hand. Not knowing whether my words were communicating my concern, I hoped the physical contact might do so more effectively. At first contact, her muscles tensed and she shrank further back into her chair. I was about to release her hand when I sensed a slight yielding, so I kept my hold on her hand. After a few moments, I noticed a progressive relaxation on her part. I held her hand for several minutes while I talked to her as I had the first few days, but still she said nothing. When she arrived the next day, she appeared even more tense than before. But this time a new message. She extended a clenched fist toward me while turning her face away from me. She kept moving the fist toward my face. I was at first confused by the gesture. I said to her, "Are you feeling angry and just want me to leave you alone and not ask your parents to bring you here each day?" And now she shook her head no, but that wasn't what she wanted, and this was the first time I got a response other than silence. But she still kept pushing the fist toward me, and I said, "Well, I'm not understanding what you mean by this." Finally, I understood that she had in her fist a message for me. I pried open her fingers. There was a message that said, "Please help me express what's going on inside myself." I was elated to receive this sign of her desire to communicate. Still, it took another hour of my empathizing with how scary it was for her to talk. She finally expressed the first sentence, slowly and fearfully. When I reflected back what I heard her saying, she appeared relieved and continued slowly and fearfully to talk. A year later, she sent me a copy of the following entries from her journal. Here's what she wrote. "I came out of the hospital away from shock treatments and strong medicine. That was about April. The 3 months before that are completely blank in my mind, as well as the 3.5 years before April. They say that after getting out of the hospital, I went through a time at home of not eating, not talking, and wanting to stay in bed all the time. Then my parents took me to Dr. Rosenberg. I don't remember much of those first 2 or 3 months other than being in his office and talking with him. I'd begun waking up since that first session with him. And when I began sharing with him things that bothered me, things that I never have dreamed of telling anyone about, and I remember how much that meant to me. It was so hard to talk. But Dr. Rosenberg cared about me and showed it, and I wanted to talk with him. I was always glad afterwards that I had let something out. I remember counting the days, even the hours, until my next appointment with him. I've also learned that facing reality is not all bad. I'm realizing more and more of the things that I need to stand up to, things that I need to get out and do on my own. This is scary, and it's very hard, and it's so discouraging that when I'm trying really a lot, I can still fail so terribly. But the good part of reality is that I've been seeing that it includes wonderful things, too. I've learned in the past year about how wonderful it can be to share myself with other people. I think it was mostly just one part of what I learned about the thrill of my talking to other people and have them actually listen, even really understand at times. I continue to be amazed by the healing power of empathy. Time and time again, I have witnessed people transcending the paralyzing effects of psychological pain when they have sufficient contact with someone who can hear them empathically. As listeners, we don't need insight into psychological dynamics or training in psychotherapy. What is essential is our ability to be present to what is alive in the other person, to the feelings and needs they're experiencing at that very moment.